You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is once again Yuval Sharon, founder and co-artistic director of the industry in Los Angeles, and currently the Gary L. Wasserman Artistic Director of Detroit Opera. Yuval and I spoke together on All Things Cage on March 2nd about his then-upcoming production of John Cage's EuropaOperas 3 and 4 at Detroit's beautiful historic Gem Theater. Rehearsals had not yet begun, and Yuval ventured that his ideas as to what might transpire and develop within and out of both the rehearsals and the three subsequent performances would surely shift, slightly or significantly, by the end of the work's run. This week, we indeed delve into in-depth conversation on some of the nitty-gritty realities of mounting Cage's anarchic works for the otherwise traditional opera stage. Yuval is no stranger to John Cage's works, and he seems genuinely enchanted by Cage's ideas. I first met him in 2012, Cage's centennial year, when he was engaged by Michael Tilson Thomas to direct a newly staged version of Cage's songbooks from 1970, first for the San Francisco Symphony and later in February 2013 for the New World Symphony in Miami in a marvelous festival entitled Making the Right Choices. Yuval's stellar cast for songbooks included none other than Meredith Monk, Joan LaBarbera, and Jesse Norman, as well as Michael Tilson Thomas himself. Still later, in Los Angeles in 2018, Yuval mounted Cage's EuropaOperas 1 and 2 from 1984-87 at Sony Pictures Studio in Culver City during his three-year residency with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Yuval was the first artist collaborator of the LA Phil, creating 9 projects during his tenure that included newly commissioned works, site-specific installations, and performances given outside the concert hall. His residency culminated in a new production of Meredith Monk's opera, Atlas, making him the first director Monk entrusted with her work. Now, weeks later, we're in the afterglow of having witnessed Sharon's EuropaOperas 3 and 4 from 1990, Cage's second opera, as mounted in Detroit's historic Gem Theater. Yuval describes this work as made entirely of recycled materials, arias that everyone is familiar with, classics from the European repertoire. The only catch, he continues, is that they're all performed at the same time. Through chance operations, singers perform arias that they select, while pianists play transcriptions of different operas, and phonographs are playing different recordings. The result is something new and original, an exhilarating, bewildering, wonderful work. There are many experiences happening simultaneously, more similar to an installation, or like when you came to the Michigan Theater to see Bliss in 2021. It does not have to adhere to our standard ideas of narrative or experience. It can be so many different things, a true collage of things we know and love. Yuval's EuropaOperas 3 and 4 was a revelation. And I, among many others, can't wait for him to take on the third and last of Cage's operas, EuropaOpera 5 from 1991, the most diminutive of the three, which he hopes to mount during his residency at the University of Chicago in May of 2025. Enjoy. Welcome to All Things Cage for the second time, Yuval. Oh.
What a treat. Thank you, Laura. I'm always so happy to be in conversation with you.
It's totally my pleasure. For our listening audience, they may remember you from, it's been now about almost 6 weeks since you were here. Right. Yuval and I spoke for an hour or so about his take on EuropaOperas 3 and 4 and 5 and 1 and 2 and all things operatic relative to Cage. And he also admitted that he hadn't even begun rehearsals yet. So his ideas or his thoughts or his opinions about things might well change after the production was over. So in the interim, I had the great privilege of going to Detroit and seeing two of the three performances with Gene Capriolio, formerly of C.F. Peters, in New York, our music publisher, and we both absolutely loved it. We were just blown away by the balance of chance and choice, as I might say. You know, Yuval is an experimental director, to be sure, but he also has very classical ideas about directing, or at least a very solid classical knowledge about directing. So I think that he toggles back and forth a bit between Age's ideas and the canon's ideas.
That's right.
Yes, so just, I don't want to put you on the spot, Yuval, but how was it for you? How was it?
Absolute pure pleasure from beginning to end, which is exactly what I felt when I worked on the songbooks and when I worked on 1 and 2 and any other experiences I've had with John Cage's material. There is something about the kind of the letting go of all of the things that are such a big part of how we normally do our jobs that is incredibly freeing. And I just loved every moment of it. I couldn't wait for the next day's rehearsal. I could not wait. I was just always in a good mood the entire time. And
Isn't that nice?
It's wonderful. Just to arrive at a rehearsal space and say, whatever emerges in today's rehearsal is going to be exactly what's supposed to happen,
And I do.
Yeah, it's a very nice feeling. Yeah.
It's also freeing, is it not, to be working in such a way that you can have sort of unmitigated or unfettered joy about what's happening because you let go of the whole sort of creative drive behind it.
Absolutely. And, I remember we were talking in Detroit as we were walking to the theater before the opening. I remember saying something. I think that Gene asked me, he said, well, what is it like to direct a John Cage piece? And I kind of said, well, actually, I see my primary job as being a coach, to all the performers more than anything else, like going through the process of making the choices with each individual performer and then encouraging them to figure out how to get through this, how to get through this experience because it's so different. And, one of the things that was really wonderful about this performance is we did kind of balance things out in between your opera three and your opera four. Your opera three was, populated by a number of younger singers, some that are more established as well. But I think by and large, we had some kind of newcomers to the opera world grappling with what it meant to do these operas that they've studied so well in this entirely new context. And then your opera four, which was cast with kind of real legendary performers that have also never done anything like this before, but are approaching it from an entirely different place. And I personally absolutely loved that balance between 3 and 4 and looking at how it made me think about how the song during the songbooks, working with someone like Joan LaBarbera on one hand and Jesse Norman on the other, what it means about seeing the same strategies and the same approaches and the same philosophy of music as embodied by people with entirely different careers and entirely different notions of canon and classical thought and classical training versus more experimental training. So I think I wanted to capture that again in setting up the casts of 3 and 4, but by and large, really, it was showing up every day to rehearsal and making the space for things to flow. And I think that was really my number one job. And for that was just an utter pleasure from beginning to end.
Right. I get that. I've directed nothing as grand as 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, but doing things like Lecture on the Weather, sort of largish works.
Yes. With
people who maybe I did a theatrical staging of Alphabet. So I was dealing with people who maybe had never been on the stage before.
Wow.
They had to be, and I always felt like, my primary job, once they were taught, once they really knew, they understood the work, they understood what the instructions were, they understood what they were supposed to be doing, then it was really just encouraging them. I was like a cheerleader,
That's how I felt.
That was exactly right. That was exactly right. Do that again. Just do it again,
Yes. And I feel like I have to do that anyway in any project I do. I feel like that's a huge part of the work, really. But the difference here is that you're not trying to bring people along to your ideas. You're actually just trying to actually get them closer to their ideas as it relates to the philosophy that Cage laid out, you know, and everyone's going to have a different approach to that. But it's not about the things that a director normally thinks about, which is, okay, come more downstage so I can see you better, or, you know, don't upstage your fellow performer here, or, you know, turn to face us so we can see more of your face, or, you know, that costume is exactly wrong. We have to change that, or, you know what I mean, or like, oh, stand right there for a second. The lighting isn't quite right. You know, like all of that stuff is gone, you know, because all of that is left to chance. And so it really is fundamentally about this kind of connection that you're forging with each and every performer as they find their own path through this piece, you know, and everyone's was really different. And realizing that one size does not fit all, and certain people needed certain extra support or less support, or could handle actions that were maybe silent or took more time, or and some people maybe a little bit less so. So, you know, so just kind of responding to each person and finding that right balance of challenging them, but also meeting their own strengths and their own ideas towards this, towards the pieces they chose and the piece and this piece that we created together.
Right. You know, in thinking about it, and maybe this isn't true, but in thinking about the distinction between your cast in three and your cast in four,
Yeah.
one might think, and perhaps erroneously, that the second group, that is to say, the more seasoned operatic stars, if you will, that appear
Right.
before, would in
Right.
some respects have more trouble adapting to the novelty of the presentational skills, perhaps.
Well, I think that is not untrue, I think. I you know, in conversations with Susan and encouraging her to do this, I think she was really intrigued. And also, I think at first, you know, maybe a little skeptical, and she really admitted to me that she was worried that these pieces that she loves so much and that she spent her whole life singing, she was just worried that there would be an irreverence there, that there would be a feeling that we're poking fun at these pieces or somehow don't like these pieces, and so we're showing how much we don't like them by presenting them in this kind of strange way. And I really had to tell her it's quite the opposite. It's actually so much love for this music that we're looking for two things. We're looking for what this work has meant to you, and we want that to be on display, as opposed to, you know, Susan did an aria from A Marriage of Figaro, you know, for example, instead of putting her in a production of Marriage of Figaro where she's dressed as a boy and et cetera, like this is just her in a kind of concert attire that lets her have her own relationship to this music became the performance, you know. And then looking for still new, the idea that there's still new ways to think about even that beloved older music, that there is so much still in there, if we present it in different ways, and if we look at it in this kind of new context, of everything around it being different. I
Right.
think once she understood that and trusted us that it wasn't about destroying these pieces at all. Then I think she could really get into it. But she did. She did, in terms of where she was going to find her pitch or where she was going to, you know, all of the things that are such a part of their practice, was, you know, something that they really had that they probably did struggle with that maybe a little bit more than performers that might still be experimenting with how they appear in different, you know, in different genres even, or in different musical worlds, like some of the performers in three.
It's interesting as a as an onlooker, Yuval, you know, somebody who knows this work, but certainly not intimately, because I've never produced it, I've never directed it, but seen it a number of times, and you know, I know it very well. I've never ever seen a more beautiful Your Opera 4.
Oh, thank you.
Never. I mean, you know, it was so moving. And I think that what you just said gets to the heart of it, you know, that what one is hearing. Jean also felt the same way, you know, that it was so beautiful. I have to say, though, you know, we saw it two nights. The first night we saw it from the front of the balcony, and the second night we saw it a little bit further back in the balcony. I loved the balcony. I loved
Balcony was the best. The balcony was
sitting in that
the
first
best.
row. I mean, I could see the crook of a finger. You know, I could see every little thing.
Wasn't it a wonderful theater too? I mean, it was perfect to be in this jewel box space, you know, with the intimacy.
It was a gem. Uh-oh.
It literally was. it's named that for a good reason.
Yes, but it was so, I mean, for all of them, not just Susan, and Susan was stunning. She was just stunning. What was the man, what was his name?
Devon Tynes, who is—
That's right, Devon Tynes, who's beautiful. Yeah.
Such an extraordinary performer. And yeah, he had a bit of a different— he really was very quick to kind of understand the scenario and felt immediately quite liberated by this experience, you know? And so I think the biggest question, he had a similar question to Susan, which is, I'd really love to stay on my pitch. And, you know, I told this to the singers in three too, where I said, look, you know, aspire to the actual key as much as you can, but don't chastise yourself if you sort of sense a tonal drift, you know, because,
right. Because
it's
it would
likely,
be neutral. It would
it's
be-
just going to be natural, but just it's about the dedication to trying to do it as written, you know, that's important. And if you know, I've said no one in the audience is going to be checking you against the original pitches, or if they are, they've got the wrong idea of how to appreciate this piece.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So I really tried to encourage them because I think for both of them, they had arias that if they started too high or too low, you know, it would get into some pretty treacherous territory for their voices. So I think for them, finding a way in which they could feel really confident about where they're starting so that they didn't suddenly find themselves outside
in
of
the
the
stratosphere
range.
Of their range.
Exactly. So
I wasn't aware, again, as a just an onlooker, I wasn't aware of their having any of those kinds of physical problems.
No, I know.
I wasn't
they
aware of any problems, actually, but I certainly wasn't aware of any vocal problems.
I think, you know, there were no vocal problems. In fact, it was, I feel like, I think, and in the case of Susan, again, who had maybe some more skepticism going into this, I think she's starting to realize as we went on that she could perform it the way she's always wanted to perform it, not being rushed by a conductor, not being, you know, like, not being forced to do any physical antics that the director is telling them to do, but actually really discovering it for themselves and in the space. And so she would do, and all the way through the third performance, there was more and more vocal letting go that happened. That was just, you know, but with each performance, just got better and better for the singers in three as well. But it is fascinating watching Susan and Devon as such legendary presences, feel that sense of freedom and discover that sense of freedom and start to slowly take it piece by piece. You know,
it was extraordinarily romantic. I mean, extraordinary. It was like, you know, the depths of love, you know, regardless really of what they were singing about. It was about them and their music, them and their, whatever it was that they were doing. It wasn't really about, you know, listening to the aria from Figaro and saying, oh, I remember that from this. It wasn't, there was none of that. It was just the relationship of these singers with these pieces in this setting.
That's right.
Was extraordinary. It was just extraordinary.
Thank you. And they really, they did such a remarkable job. It was so wonderful to work with all of them. And I it's one of those things that you kind of say, I wish it went longer. You know, I wish it was only, it's too bad it was only 30 minutes, you know, but I think they were happy that it was like, that was already just an incredibly challenging thing for them, but it was so beautiful to see them. You know, it's like I feel that way about the performers in three too, watching them get a sense of triumphing, you know, over the challenges that they saw, you know. And the challenges were not, you know, being a bastard against them, you know, like it was just rethink. And I mentioned this to all the singers, if you really go into this with a totally open mind and open heart, you might find your entire perspective of your artistry transformed at the end of it. And so I get the sense that that probably did happen to some of
Yeah,
them.
it's not great. It's not
Yeah.
great, as it should, and it should with every performance they do, you
I
know,
so
every
agree.
single performance they do.
Yeah, I
Three was
so
beautiful too. I don't want to, you know, just overlook it. Three was wonderful. I mean,
agree.
it was Mozartian to say the least. It
Oh,
was
beautiful.
lively. It was intermingling. You know, there wasn't a dull moment on the stage.
There was a lot of activity. There was a lot of activity. And again, all of it was, none of it was planned that way. You know, it's exactly what emerged in dealing with, you know, in going one by one with each of the singers, and creating their paths. You know, the thing with three, and I think I mentioned this the last time we talked, is I do feel now, having done one and two as well, it's this kind of gradual. Just this gradual, three still has a sense of the circus, I think. You know, it still
Oh.
has a sense of activity, costume changes, which we did not do in Your Opera 4. Your Opera 4 was, and I mean, this was based on the instructions that it really wants to feel more like a concert. By the time it gets to four, it wants to basically feel like a concert. And but there's still just these hints of the theatrical, you know. And I liken it a little bit to three as a circus, and four is like the circus is starting to go away, but it's not gone. You know, I think in five, I think it's totally gone, is my sense of five, is that it's even more, it's even one step further stripped away, you know, of the kind of beautiful artifice that makes up opera. So I
Right.
think in three, you know, we had all of the costumes from our costume shop. You know, each singer had six costume changes. You know, taken from the whole range of Detroit opera history. You
Great,
know,
great, great.
they were wonderful. There were such wonderful costumes, and the most remarkable coincidences would happen. Like Rolf Dawes, who was one of the baritones who was singing, you know, he would show up in the Escamillo costume from Carmen and would sing Papageno. You know, but then his next aria would be Escamillo. And he was dressed, I forgot how he was dressed now. But anyway, he was dressed in a different costume, entirely different costume. But it was like they were just mismatched, just enough, you know.
That's so fun because that
It's
happens throughout with every element, doesn't it? You know, the
that.
lighting has its own life, costumes have
Absolutely.
their own life, the
Absolutely.
arias have their own life. Everything is disconnected from everything else, but as in life, you have these beautiful little coincidences or these funny
Absolutely.
little things that happen that you almost couldn't do yourself.
No, there are so many things like that that just we couldn't believe that they came out that way. So, for example, actually with Jenny Creswell, at the very end of the piece, she sang Carmen, but and by chance was dressed as Carmen. However, the costume also by chance was Carmen at the end of the opera, when she's usually like, it's a glittering black gown, you know, as she's at the bullfight. It's the one that she gets killed in, but she sang the aria that's usually associated with her in a gypsy kind of gypsy outfit, a red dress and that kind of thing. So even within that, it was like almost, but not, but just off enough. Something else happened with Wes, one of the other baritone that sang in it, who sang Pierrot's Tanzlied from Korngold's Die Todesstadt. And as Pierrot, and we, you know, through random number generation, his prop that he got was a puppet. So it worked out really well that it was this puppet. And funny enough, the puppet is actually from our production of The Medium. So it was dressed as this character of the medium, which later Kismet Jordan, one of the sopranos, had that costume on at the very end of the piece. So anyone who was paying attention might have said, "Oh,
How
that hand puppet
funny.
he was using transformed into the human character." So this is the kind of things that you're right. Like in the end, even though everything was dictated by chance, there are these threads that wove through things that for the audience that might be really paying attention to it, invite a sense of narrativization without us supplying the narrative, you know.
Right,
But
right,
I do,
right.
audiences, we can't help but be, we are narrative makers. Like, we're constant narrative makers. That's just part of being human, I think.
Of course,
And
of course. We like
right,
things to have meaning.
we like things to have
We're
meaning.
meaning seekers.
Yes, we are meaning seekers, and we're very much like storytellers, even of our own lives. We're constantly understanding things based on a narrative of our life and based on, you know, based on narrative structures, right? And so I really try not to discourage an audience from story. It's more just encouraging them to realize there are so many potential stories in this. Right. Make up your own, you know, like this is the idea of it. And I believe, you know, I don't know how Cage related to the notion of narrative as it relates to the Euro operas, but my sense, something that we didn't do that I do kind of regret, is maybe reprinting those synopses from 1 and 2. You know, that there's different synopses for you know, for every single person in the audience, that they have a different story of what's happening in 1 and 2 based on kind of cutting up various opera narratives. And the result is such a magnificent Dadaistic, you know, like,
totally ridiculous. They're ridiculous.
Oh, and so wonderful. It's so utterly wonderful because it reminds you of the kind of contingent relationship that narrative actually has to opera. That it's like, okay, the narrative, it's good to have a narrative in opera, but it's not the reason for the opera's existence.
Exactly, exactly. And some of them are so ridiculous that the chopped up libretti that Cage made
right.
actually read like opera libretti.
Exactly. You know? They really do. They really, really do.
And it makes you sort of laugh at the genre, not to laugh at it like, say, you know, it's ridiculous. Who cares? This is stupid. It's all wrong.
Exactly.
But rather,
exactly.
It's so charming. It's so charming.
It's so charming. And you just realize, and it just helps you get to the point of why do you do opera? You're not doing it for the, no one's doing opera for the narrative, really. But the narrative ends up being a kind of springboard for what people actually want to be exploring, which is emotion, psychology, sound. There's so many other things to explore. And narrative is really just the vessel for all of those deeper explorations. You know, it's like, you know, and I'm in the book that is coming out that I just finished, it's coming out in September through Norton, called A New Philosophy of Opera. I really have a whole chapter about narrative and to really trying to advocate for an opera that decenters narrative. So, and I think that is a bit counter to how we're talking about operas these days, which is it's all about the story, you know, it's all about the narrative. And maybe that's a way to get to make opera seem more accessible. But honestly, I mean, I've never gone to opera because of a compelling story, but great storytelling is part of it, you know, and that's different. And so I think that the Euro opera really remind us about that, actually, that it's not to say there's no story, don't think about story, like we're completely non-narrative. There's no intended narrative, and that just means that there are endless possible narratives based on you as a spectator.
I think, you know, I think the extension of that also is something Cage once wrote, something like he quoted Pirandello, who said, "He is right who thinks he is," which is really kind of lovely. And it's also giving people permission to be right in their take on something.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's so singular, you have a feeling like it doesn't matter that you have an opinion because it's so singular that. But I don't think that's the case. I think, you know,
yeah,
it is singular, and you're right. You know.
Yeah, and I for my own sake, I might shift some of that language a little bit because I don't think it's about being right or wrong. It's kind of like that's kind of the wrong binary, is like what's right, you know, what's right or what's wrong. But it is a little bit of you know, the permission, giving the audience that permission to realize that how they receive it is actually matters much more than any sense of intentionality on the
it's perfect the it's perfect as it is.
It's as it is and as you perceive it. And you're not missing a puzzle piece. You know what I mean? It's not like there's a missing piece that only if you're smart enough, only if you're you know, well studied, you know, et cetera, like all of that kind of stuff that comprises so much of the elitism that makes opera seem so out of touch, you know, like that's just not part of this at all. You know, like there's just none of that. And It is true that the people that have the hardest time with this are the people that are real dyed-in-the-wool opera lovers. You know what I mean? Like, we had so many people that were brand new to, some of, for so many people, this was their very first opera, your operas three and four in
Very.
Detroit. I'm so, I love it. I'm like, this is a great first opera. I think I mentioned it when I at the dress
You
rehearsal,
did.
actually.
You did.
I
You
knew that
did.
there were a lot of people that were seeing an opera for the first time. I said, well, this is a perfect first opera,
You're
actually, because you're
seeing
getting a lot of
all of
opera.
them.
Where are you?
You're gonna
You're
see
getting all
all
of
of them.
opera all at once, you know.
You know, I don't know if I ever shared this story with you, but it's the Cage Cunningham story. I forget where this was, but they were presenting some program of Merce's work with Cage's music.
Yeah.
And this was the night before the opening. And they did just a Q&A thing with the audience. And somebody stood up and said, you know, I've read about what you do, and I've read about the relationship or the lack thereof between music and dance, and I'm just really skeptical. And you know, and both Merce and John looked at each other, you know, John chewed on his cheek a little bit. Anyway, then the evening went away, and then the next night they was the opening. They did the performance, and at the close of the performance, they did another Q&A. Same woman was there.
Oh, wow,
She
really?
said,
Okay.
she's because she came to see it. And she said, I
Yeah.
just can't, she said, I can't believe it. I couldn't believe how well that this was done by chance and these two elements came together and there were such moments of beauty and serendipity. And you know, I just it's hard for me to believe that this was done through chance. You know, how did you ever think that this would work? And
Right.
he sat there for a minute and stared at her. And then he said, you know, I think it's interesting that you feel that way. I can't imagine it works the other way.
Yes. Well, that's such a good way to put it. That's
Yes,
such a
exactly.
yeah,
Exactly.
like it seems like the other way where everything is so overburdened with intention.
Exactly. That, you know, how could that possibly line up with any single person in the audience trying to grapple with elements that may or may not have a narrative arc, you know, for them or anybody else, you know?
Yeah. In which case, then it does become a kind of murder mystery situation in which, well, either you're following and you're getting it or you're not, and something's wrong with you, you know?
Yeah, like that's so
That can be
sad.
very off-putting. It can be very
Yeah,
off-putting,
very
very
sad.
right, and exclusionary. And I just, there's something about, I've always felt that Cage's vision is so inclusive, you know, is so all-embracing. And that's where, you know, that to me is where so much of the joy of it comes from, and so much of the life of it comes from, is just the generosity of spirit is so clear in the ideas. And
I agree. I agree. That's one of the fundamental essences of a music circus, period. You know, it's inclusive and it is non-hierarchical. So you don't have, ooh, those are the important performers. So let's put them downstage. You know, let's
Right,
put those in
exactly.
that corner, which has got light, a lot of light over there.
Exactly. Yeah,
So
so I think that's been something I've been really, that's something that and I really, you know, I go back and then do, as you say, I sort of toggle between these different modes of directing, you know. And I, you know, every time I'm, you know, every time I get to Cage and get to do Cage again, it does feel like a bit of a reset and a reminder that, you know, maybe, you know, where can I build in opportunities for, you know, for less ego, you know, ego-driven choice making, you know what I mean? Or, you know, an individual choice making. Where can I leave more and more room for less hierarchical space to emerge? And you know, there's a range of possibilities there, you know, and so, but I don't think it's, you know, I think that there's something so special about doing it the way, exactly the way that Cage writes it, that that is so dedicated to that notion, not a kind of anywhere else. You do have to kind of compartmentalize maybe a little bit of, okay, here's a free moment. This is a moment where you are going to choose this, or I'm not making this choice here, and we will see what emerges night by night. And I do try and find moments like that in anything I do, but it's just not the same when you as doing everything like that, you know. I think that really then emerges in a glorious way. But I'm continuously, you know, thinking that, you know, having never met John Cage myself, And, you know, feeling just always so inspired every time I engage with his ideas. I nevertheless also try and think about ways that I could think about the evolution of those ideas in new pieces somehow, you know, like so not replicating Cajun when it's not a John Cage piece, not necessarily replicating those
Oh, of course.
strategies, but thinking about the creation of new pieces that could nevertheless embrace that same philosophy, you know, and think and wondering what that really looks like, you know. I
Right.
think that has led me personally, ever since I did the songbooks, has led me to think about spectatorship and trying to introduce an indeterminacy into how an audience experiences the work. You know, that might be having them be completely on the move through a train station or shuffling scenes, which I've done now for the both with some of the stuff I've done with the industry, but also for Lyric Opera of Chicago, taking three new pieces. And instead of presenting them kind of en suite as discrete one by one pieces, actually saying we're going to kind of shuffle these works so that new ideas might emerge between them as opposed to as isolated things. So I keep thinking about tactics like that, and to me they all derive from Cage really more than anything. And so
Interesting.
so.
Interesting. I think it, you know, I think the things that stand out in my own mind personally, in the way that you're speaking, it made me think of, I'm going to block the name of the director. It was a film director, and he did Red, White, and
Oh, are you thinking about Kieslowski?
yes. What's the third one?
Well, there was Red, White, Blue.
Red, White,
There was,
Blue. It
yeah,
was
there
blue.
were the
Oh, yes, of course.
color trilogies. And he
Yeah.
also did the Decalogue, which was so beautiful.
Yeah. No, I was thinking of that little trilogy with those three, where each one has a scene from the previous movie at least once, if not several, where you see it from the back, or you see it from this side, or from, you know what I mean? It's all recontextualized so that by the time you've seen all of these movies, you have this extraordinary feeling of lightness. Because it's like you're moving through the world, but you're absolutely not alone. Your perspective is just one of many perspectives. You begin to feel that way. But I guess what I'm getting at there is that what you were just saying made me think about structural shifts in the things that we do in artistic action, you know, that we change the form of things. Maybe not directly. We don't say, I'm going to change the form of this now, but maybe we do something which changes the form of something. And I like that very much, you know, because it's organic. It comes out of this meeting the work on its own terms. But it also goes back to how I started talking today, Yuval, and that is to say about you. When I was talking about you, and I said that you are so learned about your craft and so experienced for being such a young person, I think you're just awesome that you are those things, and yet you tackle these things that challenge those ideas in you, so you can't help but intermingle the old and the new, whatever it is that you're stepping into. You bring all of that with you, so that's what I meant when I said about chance and choice. It's like you can't help it. And I think that's what makes your work so lively, and it makes your work so playful and so joyful and so moving, is this interplay, because you have these little moments as a spectator. I have these little moments of awareness of you, and then long passages of no awareness of you. And then in you come in, there's you all again. You know. And I think that's your capital. I think you have real capital, I guess, is all I'm trying to say.
Thank you so much. But I will say that in specific to the year to the John Cage pieces I've done, I have to say that what I always find so remarkable is that and I think it's compared to a performance of your operas that I saw where it was very cold and very like emotionless and very, you know, not investing because they were, I think they thought that that's kind of the game is to not play the emotions and not,
Don't smile, be flat, be, you know.
exactly, just do nothing, you know, like don't do that. I to me, And you know, I think that reveals a lot about that director, you know? And even though that the experience of doing the Your Operas is to kind of silence your own ego and to let go of so many of the decision making, you know, the choices that we're so used to making, letting go of that, you nevertheless see that your personality does emerge. Despite that, you know, no matter, even if you're like, I'm sitting on my hands, I would normally say, we have to light them this way. They need to be in this costume. I need to see them here on the stage. I want to see them acting this way. That prop is ridiculous. Let's do something different. When all of those things are gone, you nevertheless do start to recognize things that you discover are absolutely essential for how you think about the work that you do. And so for me, I just keep thinking, and I do think that's for me really central to Cage too, is that experimentation comes from a space of play, you know, and curiosity, you know, and speculation, but all of that is all as incredibly powerful and childlike qualities, you know. And I do feel that he is asking us in his pieces to reconnect with that spirit that we all had when we were little, you know, we were first trying to understand how you put the Lego blocks together, you know. How you know, like, well, what happens if I don't build it according to the instructions? And what happens if I paint outside the lines? And what, you know, maybe I will do that, you know?
No, I think that's true. I do. But I also think very key for him was that he wanted you to work in such a way that you wouldn't know what would happen.
Yes.
But because if you could tell me with any specificity what will be the end result, it's not experimental. You know,
Yes.
you're just sort of playing out something. But the
Yes.
way that you're talking about working, you're not exactly sure what you're going to end up with. And isn't that exciting? Not
Absolutely.
everybody feels that way. You know, not everybody likes things they can't foresee. Some people don't like surprise birthday parties.
That's true.
So
True.
you kind of have to have a kind of predilection for this sort of not knowing where you're going as you go and still bring yourself to it.
Well, there's a similar, I mean, I think that is, I think that's absolutely true. And I think to that point, it's one of the things that I do sense is such a big part of why Cage sets up these ideas is to keep giving us these experiences with lack of control, which is fundamentally the reality of our world. Like anytime that we think we have control, it's an illusion. Honestly, you know, and if or it's a very brief moment of being in control of something that is going to be lost at some point, you know, whether it's, you know, biology, you know, is well, we're all eventually going to die, right? And so no matter what control we have over our whatever control we think we have over our lives will one day be taken from us,
Right.
right?
It's really momentary.
It's so momentary, and I think that there's an element of it being like, again, a fiction. It's kind of a narrative that we tell ourselves about things. I think that cluing in to having that experience of letting go of control is actually extraordinarily beneficial for us as we grow and as we learn and as we make our way in the world. Something similar I think happens, and I can't remember this quote exactly, but there's one of the Cage quotes that I absolutely adore. That's that where he said something like, you know, to be able to concentrate on multiple things, like, okay, once you're able to concentrate on one thing, try concentrating on two things at a time. I'm sure you know this quote, but then he said, and then once you're able to concentrate on two things, start concentrating on three things, and then to four, and then to five. And that mode of attention is incredibly beneficial to us as we move through the world. And I
That's true.
completely agree. You know, I completely agree with that.
Well, can we? I want to go back. We're not out of time yet, but
I know
I just
we
don't
are.
want to, I don't want to lose the thread of what you were talking about before with regard to the progression of the operas.
Yes, yes,
So
yes.
we in the Cage kind of the taxonomy world, if you will, think of the three works, one and two, three and four, and five. But you're
Yes.
right, there are five kind of slightly discrete operas, one, two, three, four, and five. They just happen
Yeah.
to be paired one and two, paired three and four, and then five. So you've
Absolutely.
done one and two. So re remind us of the I think there are 19, right? 19 singers in your opera.
One and two, it's 19 singers and an orchestra of, I think, I can't remember the exact amount, but I think it was something like between 30 and 40.
Right. It's a kind of, we call it a Mozart-sized opera. Yeah, I mean, exactly. An orchestra. And three and four was how many in three?
So three had six singers and four had two singers. Uh-huh. Three also had two pianists, four had one piano player.
And we have supers as well, or the dancers or whatever you want to call them.
So they are in the instructions for one and two. They were not in the instructions for three and four, but uh-huh. I felt like, you know, without in one and two, I had them doing a ton. But in three and four, instead, there's a note to have composers doing the record players as an additional sound world for it. You know, I don't have a lot of access to composers in Detroit. So I thought instead of that, maybe I can take one of the ideas from one and two and see if it can also go through a transformation in three and four so that they're still a bit different. But it just seems so hard for me to imagine three, especially without dance, you know, because I just feel like Cage and mostly because of Cage and Cunningham, you know, being together, you know, and how much those two different genres, but related kind of sister arts. It just seems so hard to do something that felt like a circus-like piece without an element of dance. So I ended up taking some of the ideas that I didn't want it to, but just do it at a smaller scale, you know, in one and two, I believe we had six dancers. And so for here, we had three. And they also helped basically orient the singers for what they needed to do. They sometimes interacted with the singers. And then they each had one solo in three that was originally danced to. In rehearsal, we had a singer do the aria. And then simultaneously, the dancer would respond to the aria and then set a dance. But then we just set that as its own dance piece, put on the timeline in a chance-based way. And so it still had the imprint of the singer's voice in the way that they created the piece. It just didn't happen at the same time.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that's kind of how we organized. That's kind of how we organized that.
And you also, did you not? I remember in one and two at the original production of it in Frankfurt that they weren't called dancers, but rather they were called supers because they did things like they moved large props, mm-hmm. set pieces around. They did a lot of stuff like that.
That's right.
You know, there were people inside of circles hanging on. They were being turned by the supers.
Right.
Anyway, stuff like that. Okay. And in four, we have one dancer.
We ended up having the three dancers, but they didn't have, they also had one solo in four. We used the same three dancers.
You did. Okay.
But two of them did a solo and one of them did a kind of silent action, which was she came on with her suitcase, opened it and... Right. But she also was responsible for the Victrola. So like, as opposed to in three, there are 140 cues. Wait, 140? No, I'm sorry, 300 cues for the record players.
Right.
So I did that. I did that on the first night and the last night, which was so much fun. I
remember you on the first night because I was right there in the front of the balcony.
And oh, right.
You were right down. I could have thrown something at you.
Oh, I loved doing it. And then the second night, the associate director, Alexander Gideon, he did it on Saturday night. So I could actually watch three because I kind of felt like I really wanted to see three. Because when I was doing the records, I couldn't do anything but concentrate on the records, you know? So I had no idea how the performance went.
After three and four, we move into five, which as the operas, if the audience hasn't caught on or know these works very well, they're getting smaller and smaller as time goes on. And, you know, your operas one and two was completed in 87. It was premiered. Three and four was 90 and five was 91, I think.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. So five, you haven't done yet, but you're going to be doing?
I am now dead set on doing it. There's a chance that I will do it. Next May, I'll be giving the Berlin Family Lectures at the University of Chicago. Nice. And my plan is to talk about anarchism and opera. And so Cage is going to factor in a lot to this topic.
Is this a one-off talk or is this a...
There are three discrete, it's like, I think it's three Tuesdays in May of next year at University of Chicago. And I've asked them if they can support me also doing a performance of EuropaOpera 5 as part of that. So as a demonstration of what the joyful anarchy of Cage, what you know, and that's why I've been asking you about some of Cage's engagement with anarchy, and it's been really, really wonderful to read. I got a copy of the book that you let me know about, his Anarchy, the Misostics, that
Good.
which is so wonderful, was so wonderful to read, you know, but is also very much in a way a book. You read it very differently. It's like it's really more like poetry, you know, than anything else.
I think he would say it is poetry.
I think so too. I think it's absolutely, it's like a book of poetry. That's how I took it.
Yeah,
But
it's
just to think.
poetry that is, created by brushing information against information.
Which is just so wonderful. And I think that his notion of anarchy, so I'm doing a lot of research right now on anarchy, and
Good.
both as a political movement, how Cage thought about anarchy, how opera, which is so hierarchical, you know, what are these experiments in anarchy throughout opera's history? And can we imagine opera less as a, and this, I talk about this in the book that's coming out in September as well. Can we think about opera less as a standard bearer of the status quo and more of a pallbearer of the status quo? You know, this notion that actually maybe opera is a great opportunity to really challenge all of the ways that we think about the way that society is organized, not a picture of this is the structure of the universe exactly as we know it, you know, which is how there is a history of that for opera for sure, you know, and you can see it in the architecture of so many operas that are built around the idea of a central box for the king to watch the opera in, and all these other people are surrounding that. You know, I mean, it creates the image for everybody in the audience of a hierarchical social order.
Right.
And operas, there are certainly operas that lean into that, but I think there are also many operas, and especially in America, that are trying to be much more of a renegade, you know, as it relates to social hierarchies. And so I'm really thinking a lot about that. I'm thinking about an opera company's responsibility to that too, you know, to fostering that kind of quality.
Let me interrupt you just really quickly. Did you Yuval read the piece on, there's really a critique of what you did in Detroit in the Brooklyn Rail? I'm blocking the author's name. I could look this up. I think it was called A Chance to Mourn.
I did read that. Yes, that was in, I think it was in Van Magazine, if I'm not
Oh, it
mistaken.
was. You're right. That was Van Magazine. Yes.
Yeah.
Did you read that?
I
Did
did
you?
read it, and I read it the same way I read all reviews that I get, as like, you know, like I, but all, if people love the work I do, I go, well, it's great. I'm so glad, you know, and if people disagree with it, I'm like, that's all right. You know, like I don't see, I have, I'm long past the time of thinking about reviews as some sort of judgment on the on you know from my, I think in the
Of
end you have
course,
to
of
be able
course.
to judge.
No, I wasn't asking you to comment on his critique so much as the whole notion of opera as part of its its living of
Yes, I
et
know, I know.
cetera, if you will, has to do with that it's dead, so
Yeah.
that it has that we have that as a culture, that our relationship to it is
Yeah.
that way, which I don't
You
know how
know,
I feel about that. I don't, I thought it was
look,
interesting.
if that's how that particular writer, I don't know him, but
Nor do I, and I can't even tell you his name. I'm embarrassed to say.
no, I think, you know, if that, I think there are people that come to opera as this, as something that is dead and gone. And that is just not how, if I would not commit my life to something like that, you know. So if that's what, but I can see when I was reading it, I could see how people might think about the your operas as enacting that kind of funeral. I think maybe some people might connect it to that famous quote of for 400 years Europe's been sending us their operas, and now I'm sending it all back. That
Right.
call I can kind of understand. But then why would Kidge have done 3, 4, and 5? You know what I mean? Like, what wouldn't one be enough then? Wouldn't one funeral be enough? I think to me, and again, I still end up getting revealed in the work I do, no matter what. And I do not, I think that opera, rather than dying or living, I really think it's constantly being reborn. That's the point of it, really. It is like a phoenix. It's a phoenix art form.
We have to stop.
Oh dear.
We have 1 minute and 12 seconds.
Really? How did that go so fast?
I know, it always does, doesn't it? Even when we just chatter at each other about nothing in particular, time flies.
I will just say that I love, I mean, we got a whole range of responses from 3 and 4. And in the end, the purpose of doing it is what happens for the artists and for the audience. I have the feeling that anyone that came to this performance of 3 and 4 will not see opera quite the same way, you know, in Detroit or elsewhere.
That's true.
And I, for that, I feel like it had exceeded all my expectations of the performance. And I cannot wait to do more.
Cage would agree. You know, Cage would say, you know, composing is one thing, performance is another thing, and audition is another thing.
Absolutely. Very true.
Thank you, Yuval, for your beautiful work. I can't wait to see what you do next. Truly.
Thanks, Laura. Well, I'm just so delighted to be in such close correspondence with you about Cage and about life and about all the many things that we always talk about. So thank you for being such a good friend.
I feel exactly the same way. We'll talk soon.
Take care, Laura. Thank you.
Okay. Bye, Yuval. The 2023-2024 season at Detroit Opera also includes Missy Mazzoli and Royce Vavreck's heart-wrenching opera, Breaking the Waves, inspired by the controversial Lars von Trier film, which tells the story of a woman in an extreme environment in Scotland defying her community of faith. Stephanie Childress will make her Detroit Opera conducting debut, leading the cast and Detroit Opera Orchestra in Breaking the Waves, a co-production of Opera Ventures, Scottish Opera, Houston Grand Opera, Adelaide Festival, and Théâtre National de l'Opéra Comique, that was first performed in 2019 at Scottish Opera, directed by Tom Morris. This marks the first main stage production here that features a woman as the composer, which is something I'm very excited about, says Sharon. It's a work that tells the story of a woman's agency in an impossible situation, grappling with what it means to be pious and good. It's a powerful and searing work, and Mazzoli's orchestration is oceanic, with soundscapes depicting a deeply human conflict and collision in so many ways. Human and animal worlds collide in Leos Janáček's The Cunning Little Vixen, an enchanting cinematic modern fable about a clever vixen who tries to outwit her captors. Music director Roberto Kalb conducts, and artistic director Yuval Sharon directs his production from the Cleveland Orchestra, which uses playful projections to transform singers into forest creatures, with handcrafted animations that evoke the fable's comic strip origins. We are inviting the audience into a deeper reflection of how we interact with nature. Think about nature, these forces, animals, trees, the seasons, our relation to the ever-shifting natural world, says Sharon. This will be the first Detroit performance of one of Janáček's great works. The score features some of the most beautiful music ever written. This is incredibly family-friendly and is so fun and mesmerizing, says Kalb, and the cast is spectacular. I truly think that no theater in the world can boast a better cast than Detroit Opera.